From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is America ready for natural disasters to come? I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. After hammering Puerto Rico and devastating other Caribbean islands, Hurricane Irma is heading northwest. Here's Florida Governor Rick Scott.
If you're told to evacuate, do not wait. Get out quickly.
Disaster experts are watching. Is the East Coast better prepared for a monster storm than Texas, which won't get over Harvey for decades? Every state has its own rules for protecting homes and infrastructure from natural disaster. Some have no rules at all. As the Trump administration takes another look at federal standards, are higher building costs worth it to reduce damage and the need for reconstruction? Later on today's Talking Point, the last thing professional Democrats want to hear about, Hillary Clinton's upcoming book tour. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Just days after Harvey devastated so much of Texas and parts of Louisiana, the monster hurricane Irma is bearing down on Florida. Two other storms are building in the Atlantic. Is America protecting itself from potential disasters in the near future? Today's Talking Point, Hillary Clinton's new book promises to tell what happened to her presidential campaign last year. Advance sales may set records, but Democrats fear a return to the campaign that will never end. First is news update. At a bipartisan Oval Office meeting yesterday, President Trump stunned fellow Republicans by making a debt limit deal with the Democrats. This morning, he followed up with a tweet about DACA. Quote, "For all those DACA people concerned about your status during the six-month period, you have nothing to worry about. No action." Conservative Republicans are furious, but House Speaker Paul Ryan says the president wants a moment of bipartisanship with another storm approaching. Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi described yesterday's event in the Oval Office.
It was a long meeting, and I was very proud of the Senate Democratic Leader, Chuck Schumer. He could speak New York to the president.
Josh Dossie is White House reporter for Politico. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
So, talking New York, were they?
They were talking New York. The president stunned his own Treasury Secretary and the Republican leaders by immediately agreeing to a three-month extension of debt ceiling that combined with a storm package. He also told Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi that he would consider getting rid of the debt limit altogether, so no votes would ever have to be taken again. And then this morning we reported he called Schumer and Pelosi and told them both that he was pleased with news coverage of yesterday's events, particularly what he saw on TV, and he was looking forward to working with them again. So it's been a pretty dramatic 24 hours here at the White House. A president who really has not shown much of a tendency to work with Democrats so far now seems to be fully going in on that approach.
And he's pleased with the news coverage. Does that seem to be what it's all about?
I think that's partially what it's about. He called them both and said that this morning. He said that it showed that Americans, you know, that politicians could get things done on a bipartisan basis. And I think with the hurricanes that are coming in right now, he wanted to do that. He wanted to get rid of this, get it off his plate. It stunned almost everyone I spoke to in the White House yesterday. I don't think anyone else was aware that that's what he was going to do. But as the president is prone to do, we are all surprised all the time.
And, of course, that's the way the House Speaker explains it. He says he wanted some bipartisanship. Now, apparently, Nancy Pelosi asked him to tweet about DACA. As I indicated earlier, he did.
Yes, he did. He did not get the language exactly what she wanted, but he basically tweeted her message that you know, for the next 6 months, no one would be rounded up or no one should worry about the priorities. And I think it's kind of surprising to a lot of these Hill Republicans, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, and others who have privately encouraged the president not to tweet and have been disappointed time and time again to see that Nancy Pelosi suggested a tweet, and he followed through immediately.
You talk about 6 months for the DACA people. 3 months is the deal on the debt ceiling. The Republicans wanted much more than that. What's the difference, and how does 3 months mean more leverage for them?
Well, the three-month process is interesting. What it's going to show is a showdown at the end of the year over a longer-term agreement. A lot of the Republicans did not want to give the Democrats leverage in 3 months to come back to the table and ask for something else in return for the debt ceiling being raised. And they were saying, essentially, you know, we should strike a longer deal now. If we are going to raise the debt ceiling without having any spending cuts, without getting anything particular that we want, just doing the clean raise, it should be longer. Because if it's not longer in 3 months, Democrats are going to come back and say, we're not going to raise it unless we get something else that we want. And, debt ceiling votes are particularly hard for Republicans because a lot of the conservatives back home have run against cutting debt, cutting spending, and having to take a tough vote saying, you know, we raise the debt ceiling without any sort of promise in return is not easy.
Okay, so what about the concern about next year's midterm elections? They're a long way off. How will this affect those?
Well, that's a question everyone in Washington is asking, Warren. Yesterday you saw the president fly to North Dakota with Heidi Heitkamp, the senator, on Air Force One.
She's a Democrat.
The rally and called her a good woman, said he was looking forward to working together with her. And I think that move was not particularly loved by Republicans. But I think the president is particularly frustrated with Republicans for not passing much legislation so far, and he seems to be wanting to try something new. So you have the NRSC, which runs elections for the Senate Republicans, wanting the president to go out and criticize Democrats, really go after them, particularly in states where the president won heavily, like North Dakota and West Virginia. And you have a president who seems sometimes to want to make a deal instead of going out and hitting his opponent in the face. And it kind of depends on the day. So I don't think anyone really knows exactly how the president will approach the midterms.
So that seems to be. And once again, the Republicans didn't know what was going to happen when they went into the Oval Office either. And didn't take long for the president to shock them to their shoes. Josh Dossie, it's great to have you on our program.
Good day, is it, Warren?
All right. Look forward to the next time. Take care. In a moment, is America ready for disasters to come? This is To the Point from PRI.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Hurricane Irma has already lived up to its reputation as a monster storm as it heads toward Florida. Governor Rick Scott is warning of disaster in no uncertain terms.
I cannot stress this enough. Do not ignore evacuation orders. Remember, we can rebuild your home. We cannot rebuild your life or your family.
Our first guest has already been evacuated from Florida to Houston. His job is to track storms and try to predict where they'll strike next. He is Sharon Majumdar, professor at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. Professor, thanks so much for joining us, especially under the circumstances in which you find yourself already evacuated from Miami.
Thank you.
Tell us what you expect from the next storm, Hurricane Irma.
Well, with Hurricane Irma, it's currently between the north coast of Hispaniola and the Turks and Caicos Islands, and the prediction is for it to continue along that path towards the west-northwest for probably about the next couple of days through till about Saturday morning. And then the big question, and the very difficult question, is exactly when is Irma going to turn, and how sharp is that turn going to be? And those questions then will determine the type of impact that it has on Florida. And unfortunately, it's a very heavily populated area. Many, many people live by the beach there. And so it's very important that they are all evacuating. And we have to just essentially wait and see, and everybody has to sort of heed the warnings and the evacuation order.
How was your own evacuation? How did it go?
It went very smoothly. The reason being that I've been noticing this with my friends and discussing it even over the weekend, that Irma formed on the 30th of August, and even the very long-range model forecast were suggesting a little bit of a potential for Irma to come towards Florida. So I booked a flight to Houston, to my friend's place here, on Sunday, thinking, well, I'll keep it open, but then if the forecasts take Irma away from Florida, then I can happily cancel. Unfortunately, I couldn't cancel, but that was sort of the process that I went through for the evacuation. So I took a flight up this morning.
Predictions always difficult to make, but is there any way you think that Irma might not strike Florida?
Well, that's the solution that we're all hoping for. And the only way that I see that is if Irma turns a little bit earlier than is being predicted. They do shift back and forth a little, but some of them do shift a little bit to the east of Florida. But unfortunately, they're still keeping some of the most intense part of the storm over Florida. So we're hoping that the models are wrong here, and that they, the Irma actually turns a little bit earlier than what they're predicting.
So there's no way that it would go over the Gulf and hit Texas again?
Very highly unlikely. We haven't seen any model solutions, that even from the big spaghetti of ensemble models, that are suggesting an impact on Texas.
Now we have behind Irma hurricanes called Jose and Katia. What about those?
Yes, unfortunately, we have three hurricanes out there right now. So Jose is trailing Irma right now. And unfortunately, it's predicted that Jose is likely to clip some of the northeastern part of the Caribbean islands, the exact same parts where Irma already caused quite a lot of devastation. For the United States' sake, that we're hopeful that Jose will curve out to the ocean and not cause any more damage. But it is looking like a powerful hurricane. It's currently a Category 2 hurricane, and it's forecast to intensify potentially to Category 4. And then we have Katia, which is in the Gulf of Mexico, and that's a Category 1 hurricane that's expected to begin moving towards the Mexican coast, and unfortunately strengthening too.
So I take it that it's warm water that is the cause in some ways of these storms. Is it unusual, particularly, that they would all arise so suddenly all at the same time?
The warm water is certainly one of the critical ingredients, and especially around September, the water is very warm in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. In addition to that, there's a confluence of other factors that are considerably supportive of hurricane intensification, one being abundant moisture in the atmosphere, and another being relatively low vertical wind shear. And what that means is that the winds at the lower levels of the atmosphere are fairly similar to winds at the higher levels of the atmosphere, and so a very symmetric structure of the hurricane can build deep up in the atmosphere, up to about 15 to 17 kilometers or so. So it becomes a very sort of perfect type formation there due to the lack of vertical wind shear. So it's really a confluence of those favorable factors and then a few others, like the lack of interaction with land, that are supportive for these storms to intensify.
So is it possible that Jose and Katia both might strike the United States as well as Irma? Would that be the worst-case scenario?
That would be a worst-case scenario that, thankfully, for the sake of that, Jose appears to be a storm that would probably move away from the United States. At least that's what the five-day forecast is giving. And then Katia is expected to make landfall on the coast of Mexico. So unfortunately, there will be a landfall, though it's not predicted to make landfall in the United States.
All right. Sharon Majumdar, you're very kind to talk with us. And once again, having, I should say, evacuated yourself from Miami to Houston, but sounds like the right thing to do. Many thanks for being with us.
Okay. Thank you. My pleasure.
Alice Hill is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She was a special assistant to President Obama and his senior director of resilience policy when she helped draft the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard. Alice Hill, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What is the status right now of the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard?
Approximately 10 days before Harvey made landfall, President Trump rescinded that order without comment.
What is
so
that?
It is not in effect.
What does that mean to you?
That means that as we look at rebuilding from Harvey and potentially Irma, there is no stated requirement that we build back better. And by building back better, I mean that we ensure that damage that we know was caused by these storms, we protect against it literally by building facilities, buildings higher, structures higher. That means the floodwaters are less likely to cause long-term damage.
What about our situation now? You're talking about what might happen when these things are over with. Is Florida prepared for Irma?
Florida is prepared. It has had a strong building code since Hurricane Andrew hit in 1992. That was a huge wake-up call, and they put into place much stronger building codes, some of the strongest in the nation, to protect against wind damage. Unfortunately, in recent years, Florida, because they had not experienced what they may experience with Irma, have rolled back some of those standards, at least for northern Florida. But they stand well prepared, other than massive development in areas that are now prone to higher storm surge as a result of sea level rise.
So they're okay, or at least better off than they were for wind, but they have a problem with water.
Yes. And of course, Miami is a poster child for sea level rise occurring. It sits on limestone, so the seawater can enter. Right now, they're resorting to pumps, raising roads. But when you get a large storm with additional winds pushing water up against a very flat area, we could see massive flooding in Florida.
I take it that.
And then,
go ahead. Excuse me. No, go ahead.
Well, then our hope is that when you rebuild higher, simply to be able to accommodate future flooding, as is anticipated with sea level rise, as well as higher intensity with our storms.
And had the order that the president has now rescinded remained in effect, would there have been requirements then for people in Florida and other states as well to rebuild higher?
Those requirements were in the rulemaking stage, but I anticipate what would have occurred and still could occur is what happened after Sandy. It was a requirement that if state and local governments took federal money to rebuild, they had to rebuild higher. And we could still do that. President Trump could still do that. I hope he does, because that will be much better protection for the people of Florida, as well as for federal taxpayers who are subsidizing and would subsidize any rebuild that would occur.
What about Houston? You said that that Florida learned a lot from Andrew in 1992. What's the situation in Texas?
Unfortunately, it's about the exact opposite. Texas has been rated as having one of the weakest building codes in the country. So that means that their structures sustained higher damage than they would have if they had been built to a higher, more protected level. When we rebuild, I think it's a fair question for taxpayers to ask, should we invest in areas that do not invest in themselves to protect against harm? And that will be a debate I think the nation needs to have as we see increasing threat from the changes brought by climate. The increased temperatures are causing more storms, more flooding, and sea level rise. We need to discuss who's going to pay for that when it occurs.
If it's taxpayers, it might come from the Federal Flood Insurance Program. What's the state of that?
That program is essentially bankrupt. It's close to $25 billion in the hole. That's because we continue to subsidize building and homes in areas that are at known flood risk. They do flood repeatedly, and we have paid for those claims. We have not insisted that the premiums reflect the true risk of living in those areas. Congress has attempted to achieve actuarially sound premiums, but due to protest from homeowners, we have not achieved those yet. And it's anticipated that the program will be even more in debt as a result of Harvey and certainly if Irma hit as well.
So homeowners don't want to pay for insurance, and if they don't, the rest of us do.
That's essentially what occurs. Now, of course, there are about 80% of the people who get flood insurance through the National Flood Insurance Program are paying as in ordinary insurance. They're not getting anything extra subsidized from the federal government. But it's a small group of 20% of homes that are suffering repeat flooding and are highly vulnerable that we are subsidizing and cause a great deal of damage. And many of those homes, unfortunately, are located in Louisiana, Texas, and Florida. About 50% of the homes are in those locations. So this is an issue we need to confront, and Congress is looking towards reauthorizing that program. So these are very real issues for the United States.
Alice Hill, now at the Hoover Institution, formerly Special Assistant to President Obama, one author of the Federal Flood Risk Management Standards that the president has rescinded. Mark Beauvais is with us. He's Senior Research Scientist and Meteorologist for Munich Reinsurance America, Inc. Good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
What about the insurance industry? It's an enormous industry in this country. And what is likely to happen to it as a result of the situation we're faced with these storms in places that simply apparently are not always prepared?
Yes, I think the insurance industry as a whole is well prepared to handle these storms. And we've done a lot of work to try to help make communities much more resilient towards these types of storms. Dozens of insurers and reinsurers who write business in the United States sponsor the nonprofit Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, or IBHS for short. Their mission is twofold. The first is to better understand how natural disasters cause damage to buildings, both to individual components and buildings as a complete structural system. The second is to lobby state governments to implement stronger building codes, including contractor training provisions and building code enforcement.
When the standards aren't what they should be and damage has occurred and people don't have insurance, the taxpayers are the last resort. I take it the insurance industry under those circumstances has no responsibility.
No. Insurance and reinsurers sell contracts for a premium. We agree to pay for coverage for certain types of risk. That's how the social mechanism works. And unfortunately, if people do not have property insurance, there's no other mechanism for them to recover anything for the damages they received.
Okay. I want to talk to you after we take a break about examples, particularly in Texas, where building codes have not been up to snuff, but where they might, in fact, have helped prevent a damage. Seems to me that's an important thing to talk about at this point. Again, with Mark Beauvais at the Munich Reinsurance America, Inc. We're going to do that after we take a break. And later on our talking point, the last thing professional Democrats want to hear about, Hillary Clinton's upcoming book tour. This is To the Point from PRI.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Norman Olney back with To The Point. You're talking today about disaster preparedness. Florida is better prepared than Texas. We will find out. Irma hasn't struck there yet. But, of course, Harvey has hit Texas, and the damage is enormous. And Mark Beauvais, back to you at Munich Reinsurance America, Inc. What are the places in Harvey, in Texas, that might have been better prepared, which are going to have a hard time paying for reconstruction?
A very good question. We need to take note that resiliency and mitigation efforts are different depending on the natural peril in question. If you're talking about wind, you know, even features like hurricane straps and shutters on windows are enough to create a notable difference in building conformance. So the area that had this kind of high winds that would have done better with some stronger codes would have been Port Aransas, the Rockport area, that really did see Category 3, 4 winds. However, if we're talking about flood and you live in a floodplain, really the only way to make your home resilient to flood is to elevate it, as Alice had mentioned. So this makes flood resiliency more of a land use issue than an actual construction standard issue.
How extensive are the areas where houses simply weren't elevated sufficiently and consequently were virtually destroyed by flooding?
You have to make a distinction between coastal storm surge and inland flooding as well. A lot of homes were instantly destroyed, but another good example is Hurricane Ike in 2008, which hit just north of Houston. The Bolivar Peninsula there had almost complete losses, except the Institute for Business and Home Safety built about a half dozen test homes using their fortified resiliency program, and they were up on stilts about 25 feet high. They were among the only houses to survive the storm with very minimal damage. In fact, most of the damage that occurred to these structures was due to other homes floating into them and damaging them.
So we heard earlier that Florida learned from Andrew in 1992. Texas apparently did not learn from Ike in 2008.
Some states have learned the lessons of past hurricanes quite well. Florida, as mentioned previously, did very well with the experience of learning from Hurricane Andrew. But some other states still take a much more laissez-faire attitude towards building codes.
Mark Beauvais, once again, with Munich Reinsurance America, Inc. Paul Kirshen is with us, professor in the School of the Environment and an academic director of the Sustainable Solutions Lab at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Boston has had something called the Big Dig, which went on for years and wasn't terribly popular with people in Boston. And yet, it's my understanding that as a result of the Big Dig, Boston is better prepared for the kinds of disasters that might occur there than it would have been before.
Yeah, certainly, Mass DOT, the builder of the Big Dig, a couple of years ago realized the Big Dig tunnels might be vulnerable to increased coastal flooding. So they actually commissioned a study by UMass Boston to develop a very detailed model of the possible flooding of the present and future climates, and then took the results and now acting on them to fortify parts of the Big Dig system, the tunnel system, and also the vent buildings that are vulnerable to present and future flooding. So they've taken action to deal with, present and short-term flooding conditions.
Now we're talking about infrastructure opposed to homes and the buildings that we were talking about before. What's the important distinction here as far as infrastructure is concerned? Obviously, individuals can't do anything about it.
Well, okay, infrastructure, we mean, transportation networks, water, wastewater treatment plants, buildings, flood control systems themselves, and so on. These are usually run by public entities. And they are designed to handle a certain magnitude of floods, whether it's flood from extreme rainfall or flood from a coastal surge, or in a case of a coastal city like Boston that's drained by rivers, a combined flood from rivers and storm surge. So they are designed to handle a certain magnitude storm. The problem is with climate change and higher sea levels, the magnitudes of these storms are increasing. And so essentially, everything that's been built in the last couple of decades to old design standards is immediately out of date. And so they're all vulnerable to increased flooding from the climate of the future.
I take it flood maps are being updated.
Well, not by FEMA, but they are being updated by many of the cities. So, you know, cities are on the front line of infrastructure management. And I know, like, you know, Boston, New York, San Francisco, in these cities I know of, and certainly many foreign cities, they have produced flood maps of this is the present floodplain. This is what the floodplain might look like in 2030. This is what it might look like in 2050, 2070, even 2100. So they are trying to do their job to protect the infrastructure and the services that infrastructure provides to make society function.
Let me go back to Alice Hill at the Hoover Institution, formerly with President Obama, and drafting the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard. San Francisco just mentioned the San Francisco Bay Bridge had a collapse as a result of an earthquake some years ago. The rebuilding has taken place, but it's my understanding that it is not in many ways accommodated the possibility of flooding, pardon me, on the east side of the bridge.
That's correct. That bridge, actually, no federal funds were used for that bridge. California decided to go ahead. It was about $6 billion cost. They did not include consideration of future sea level rise, and already they are requesting $17 million worth of mitigation work to handle flooding near the toll booths that will start occurring on a routine basis. As we've seen in cities up and down the East Coast, coastal flooding as a result of higher tides, there's just simply more water to spread. And that's the example of what we don't want to have happen in the future. We can't continue to just look at the past to guide these decisions as to what our infrastructure should be resilient to in the future. The future will look very different than what we have historically recorded as extreme events. We will see more extremes as we move ahead.
And Paul Kirshen, it's my understanding that from what we're hearing and what I've seen before, that the aftermath of the storm may well be worse than the storm.
I mean, in terms of recovery?
Yeah.
That's certainly the case. I mean, there's you know, when a storm occurs, there's direct damages to buildings and infrastructure systems. But then there are all these cascade impacts that occur because an infrastructure system can't be used. And it multiplies through the economy. Like if you can't get to your building because the transportation network's out, you can't work that day. And therefore, it reverberates to the whole economy. I also want to bring up a little bit of the issue of equity and social justice. You know, low-income people are more dependent on public transportation than wealthier people. Low-income people often work in the service industries where they need to go to work every day to get paid, whereas other people can often telecommute. And so there's this whole layer of equity and social justice which cuts through all dealing with these natural hazards. And it's important to keep that in mind in our planning.
Alice Hill, your take on that?
I think that's absolutely correct. We need to keep focused on this in our future planning.
And Mark Beauvais, you're with the reinsurance industry. Is inequity and social justice, are those things you're able to be concerned about, or do you have to let governments take care of them?
We are concerned. Resilient communities, no matter what their social or economic status, are win-win situations for every stakeholder involved. Homes that stay standing protect the lives of the families within, and if they stay standing, policyholders don't have to pay a deductible or be displaced. A community whose residents aren't displaced after a natural disaster can get back on their feet much faster, and both the federal government and insurers and reinsurers pump billions of dollars into that community to help them recover. But ultimately, the more resilient these communities are, the less people have to pay out of pocket. And of course, insurers and reinsurers don't mind paying fewer claims due to resilient communities as well.
Is your industry taking climate change pretty seriously?
Yes, we at Munich Re and many others in the industry take climate change very seriously.
Paul Kirshen, what about Boston? Is that a place where climate change is, in fact, regarded as a real threat?
Well, yes, very much. And we have support from all levels of government, from the governor of the state to town managers. And, of course, we have a tremendous academic community around here. So Boston, while not totally prepared now, is certainly moving in the right direction. And also they're trying to control their emissions of greenhouse gases, which is, of course, the driving factor of climate change, what's causing it. Some say Boston is not totally prepared yet, but we're certainly moving in the right direction.
Alice Hill, back to you. The president, current president, has rescinded the federal flood risk management standard that you tried to put into place. You said the rules were being made for that, and they still could be restored. What is the sense, do you think, of Congress at the moment? They certainly are faced with enormous costs as a result of Harvey already. There's great concern about what might happen in Florida, not just from Irma, but from whatever might come next. Do you think that there's a chance that there might be some federal action to try to put off the costs of future disasters and the kind of aftermath cascading impacts we just heard about?
I believe so. The dynamics behind this are interesting. It is a fiscal conservative issue not to want to repay in the future. I think it's attractive to folks who want to be prudent with taxpayer dollars. And so for more conservative members of Congress, you saw with Sandy, there was some question whether we should be engaged in these kinds of rebuilds. That debate will resurface. The delegations that are involved in Florida and Texas tend to be more conservative in many instances. So this should allow this issue to surface. I would also note that there's a bipartisan caucus that's growing in Congress directed at figuring out better ways to prepare for the impacts of climate change. So my hope is all of these groups converge and we have an honest conversation about what the nation needs to do as it faces a very extreme threat to its economic health, as we've heard, public health, as well as to many of those in our communities who are the most vulnerable.
I can't help noting that you're at the Hoover Institution, which is regarded as a pretty conservative place. Are you and your colleagues talking about this in the hallways, or is the Hoover Institution not as conservative as it's been reputed to be?
Well, they do view this is a fiscal conservatives issue, at least in many of the conversations that I've had in the hallways. And certainly they've been highly supportive of my work, including work on national security risks posed by climate change, as well as looking at ways we can ensure that our economic system is more responsive to the threat posed by climate change impacts.
So is it conservative, then, to spend more in recovery, for example, to elevate the buildings beyond where they were, whatever that might cost? Is it worth it? Is it worth whatever additional cost that involves? And the same thing with infrastructure.
Well, there's the studies that we have, and certainly the federal government, FEMA, has been engaged with others, National Institute of Building Sciences, to get the best analysis. But the most recent analysis showed that for every dollar we invest in mitigating risk, that is preparing for future floods, we save at least $4 in the recovery. And if you look at the volume of events we're having, that very quickly adds up to substantial savings for anyone investing in that. And certainly we've found in, for example, in Florida, after they adopted the wind standards in their building codes, they had a big hurricane in 2005, Hurricane Charley, and a University of Florida study showed that the homes built to that more resilient standard suffered far less damage. So that's why it has been very insightful to learn that if we build better, we can save ourselves a lot of money in recovery, which gets us back and running faster, which leads to greater prosperity for all of us.
Mark Beauvais, back to you. You're in the reinsurance industry. Is there a tendency after a disaster for people to say, well, we won't be hit again by anything like that, therefore we don't have to worry that much about the future, and a tendency to try to save money rather than taking the kinds of precautions that are needed?
Unfortunately, yes. Sometimes people misinterpret what the terms 100-year event or 1,000-year event mean. That doesn't mean that in a severe event that occurs in 2017 in a particular location will only reoccur in the year 2117. It just means that there's 1% chance in a given year of an event of that severity occurring at a given location. And we see that pattern, too. A lot of people, especially with flood insurance, which is only mandated
mandated if you own a mortgage. Studies from the Warnant School show about 33% of national flood insurance policies are dropped within 3 years of buying a house because no one is necessarily looking if they maintain coverage. To quickly amplify Alice's point, in August 2004, I had the opportunity to go to Punta Gorda on the Florida Gulf Coast of Florida 3 days after the passage of Category 4 Charley. This area saw wind speeds in excess of 140 miles per hour, but homes that were built to the recent 2003 International Building Code in the state sustained little to no damage in these very severe damage regions. It was a dramatic and clear illustration that we can build to resist all but the strongest of wind storms, and it's a lesson that we need to take to the rest of the nation.
All right. I just want to point out that as we have been speaking, the Senate has passed a $15 billion hurricane aid package for both Irma and Harvey. It, of course, will have to pass the House. The House passed one for $7.9 billion. That was yesterday, I think, before there was concern about Irma. So we'll see what they are able to put together when they get together, as they presumably will in the very near future. I want to thank you all for being with us. Great to have you. Mark Beauvais again with Munich Reinsurance America, Inc. Paul Kirshen at the Sustainable Solutions Lab at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Alice Hill, now at the Hoover Institute, formerly with the formerly special assistant to President Obama and drafter, one of the drafters of the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard. And also Sharon Majumdar, whom we heard to earlier at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Science at the University of Miami, who has decamped from Miami to Houston, told us a lot about what to expect next from the storms that are upcoming. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Back in a moment with what the Democrats are now perhaps even more concerned about than the ongoing campaign. Let's put it that way. That's To the Point from PRI.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Warren Holland here with today's talking point. What happened? That's not a question. It's a statement. It's also the title of Hillary Clinton's new book about last year's loss of the presidential election to that unlikely Republican winner, Donald Trump. The book will be out next week. It's already topping advanced bestseller lists, but elected Democrats, party officials, campaign operatives are dreading the publicity and the months-long book tour to come. That's according to Edward Isaac Dover, who is chief Washington correspondent for Politico. Great to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Good. Thank you. You've talked to a lot of people, and the lead of your story today talks about picking the scabs of 2016. Is that the way the Democrats are looking at this?
They are. This is not something that they want to relive. They feel like it's time to move forward, and the part that is making a lot of people very frustrated is that there is stuff in the book from Clinton about Bernie Sanders that's pretty rough on him, and that is not about making amends. It says that she feels like he was treated ridiculously and given a free pass on saying things that could never be true while she was held to a different standard, and that he's not really a Democrat. And that, for a Democratic Party that is trying to bring everybody back together and move forward to the next thing, that is not where they want to be. There is a Democrat from Northern California named Jared Huffman, a congressman who supported Clinton, and he said to me, we're at a moment when we're trying to move the party forward stronger together. If you, of course, Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan. So
yeah,
that is where a lot of Democrats are, and also even a lot of Republicans who just feel like, is there ever a point, it's already September of 2017, will we ever get past the 2016 election?
You talked to one guy who said she ought to zip it.
Yes, and that is not that is a person who's been in conversation with her over the last couple of months, and
wow.
She was writing the book. That is not the way that Clinton feels about this. She feels like she has a right to say something. She feels like she has what to say, and she will say it. And that is backed up in her mind and justified given the advance sales that you were just talking about that are through the roof, and the events that have already started ticketing are quickly sold out. She starts in New York on Tuesday at the Barnes & Noble in Union Square there, and she'll be around the country doing events all through December. Now, that's good news for people who want to see her. That's bad news for people who don't want this to just be the ongoing Hillary versus Trump show through another fall.
Not always going to be cheap to see her. She's going out of the country. She's going to Toronto. And the VIP platinum tickets there go up to $3,000?
Yeah, and that is to some people who are concerned about the way that Clinton doesn't always think about the optics. It seems to a deja vu of the whole paid speeches controversy that was part of the attack on her through the 2016 campaign. So, but of course, she's not running for president again, and this is happening outside of that way of thinking. It's bringing back a lot of bad memories for people and things that they don't want to have to relive. Talk to former Clinton campaign operatives, people who worked for her on the campaign last year, who say things when I bring up to them the book tour, like, oh God, or this is the final torture, I can't stand it. This is where the minds are of the ones who were on her payroll last year.
I understand that among the people she mentions, no surprise, former President Obama. What'd she say about him?
Well, she talks about some of the good moments between them, and she also speculates at one point in the book about what would have happened if Obama, while still president during the campaign at some point, maybe this point last year, had done a primetime address to address the Russian hacking and be more out front on it than he was. And that is something that is not shocking to the Obama people, that she feels that way. It's a complaint that they've seeded out there a little bit. Interestingly, her team did make the former president's team aware that there were going to be some things like that in the book. There is a very clear swipe, though, at Joe Biden at another point in the book where she says says that my campaign didn't really have a clear message and stand for anything. Well, he campaigned for me, so what is he talking about? Neither she nor her team was in touch with Joe Biden or Biden's staff to warn them that that was coming.
So the president got a heads up, but Biden didn't.
That's right.
What about her own marriage?
That is part of the book, too, and it's not it's not the part of a lot of juicy details there. She talks about how Bill Clinton is the love of her life and has been her rock through a lot of things, and that she's just so happy that she has had that relationship to lean on him.
Okay, so the Democrats, you indicate, are not particularly—oh, I have to ask you what happened speaking to Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri.
So I walked up to her at the Senate yesterday, and I said, Senator, you excited for Hillary's book tour? And she said to me, I beg your pardon? And I said, are you excited for Hillary's book tour? Because it did seem like she was making a show of and not having heard me. And she just shook her head and walked away and did not seem that she wanted to engage in that conversation at all. And notably there, McCaskill is one of the Republicans' top targets for next year. She's up for running for her third term in a state that went very heavily for Donald Trump and is expected to be a tough race.
What about the Republicans? How are they reacting to this? Are they happy to see the Democrats unhappy?
Some of them are. Like, there are a lot of divisions within the Republican Party right now, and Republican operatives will tell you there's nothing that brings Republicans together better than attacking Hillary Clinton. And so there's that sense, but I talked to John McCain yesterday, who, of course, ran and lost in 2008, and he pointed out to me that he did not write a book after he lost, and that you have to move on, and you have to quickly move on, he said. The one that I was even more surprised by was Lou Barletta, who's a congressman from Pennsylvania and is running for Senate next year as a close Trump ally. I walked up to him and I asked him what he thought about this, and he said it's not really part of what he's thinking about right now. He's not, and so he did not want to take the bait on it. Even he seemed unwilling to go down through another round of 2016 talk.
So does this appear, with the book tour you mentioned going on until December, that is going to be something that the media will, in fact, pick up on? And whether the Democrats and the Republicans like it or not, are we going to be hearing a lot about Hillary Clinton?
I mean, come on, Warren. You know we are. Of course we are, because there's what's in the book, and then there are all these events. She's going to speak at a bunch of these events, and there will be a level of interest in what she has to say. And I think on top of that, the chances that we get through the next few weeks without the president tweeting about Hillary Clinton and the book and that she doesn't accept blame or all of those things are very low. Of course the president's going to be paying attention to this, because he is always paying attention to Hillary Clinton news. And the more that it's on cable TV, which it likely will be, the more that it is likely to get into his head because of how much cable TV he watches.
So the president himself, then, you think, is happy to see this. But he's just going to say things he's not going to like.
Yes, but he likes the fight with her. That part of this is something that he enjoys, has always enjoyed, and he sees the benefit to himself politically from having that fight.
All right. This is one of those interviews where you ask a lot of questions when you know the answers in advance. Clearly, the stage is set, and we will be seeing the results, I take it, beginning on Tuesday, you said, at Barnes & Noble in New York.
Yep. Thanks.
All right. Edward Isaac DeVere, good senior White House, senior Washington correspondent for Politico. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.